On Thursday, the 15th of May, The Spectator is hosting a live book club event. Sam Leith, the host of this podcast, will be joined by former Telegraph editor-in-chief and military historian Max Hastings. It will be an opportunity to talk about Max's new book, Sword, D-Day, Trial by Battle, as well as mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day. The full details are as follows. 7:30 on Thursday the 15th of May at the Shaw Theatre in Euston, London, and tickets start from £27.50, although I believe there are ticket options that include a signed copy of the book. For those tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/bookslive. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and my guest this week is the novelist and poet Joe Dunthorne, but we're here to talk about his first non-fiction book, which is called Children of Radium. Joe, welcome. Quite early on, it becomes clear that this is not even the book you're intending to write. Sort of Withnell style, you've written a book by accident. You were going to write about your grandmother, weren't you?
That was the idea, yeah, and I had a kind of limited idea, probably like the ideal lack of knowledge about what her life was like, just little enough to really think it would be a great idea to write about her life, just little enough to have this kind of fantasy about what I thought her childhood had been like growing up in as a Jewish girl in 1920s and 30s Germany. And then I made the mistake of actually interviewing her about her life. And yeah, she told me all the ways in which I had it completely wrong.
And it's actually, she was quite a kind of crosspatch sort of figure.
Yeah, she was, because she lived all over the place in her life. She grew up in Germany, but then when she was, I think, 12 or 13, they fled to Ankara in Turkey. And there she was for another decade. And then she met my Scottish grandfather, but he worked for the British Council. So they were in Bratislava, they were in Reykjavik, they were in Tehran before ending up in Glasgow and then Edinburgh. So yeah, she did spend the last 40 or so years of her life in Edinburgh, but she had this very, patchwork life. And she used to say, you know, I don't have a home. I've never had one place that has kind of held me.
I mean, that movement, one of the sort of things that made me do a double take at an early page is, you know, as a Jewish person growing up in the 30s, you say, you know, fled 1,000 miles or moved 1,000 miles, but it was east rather than west, which was, I was like, hold on a second, that's not normal.
Right.
Well, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves on why they went to Turkey rather than, say, Germany or France or the UK. But when was it that you sort of stumbled on what becomes the central story of this?
Right. So after I'd interviewed my grandmother, I kind of gave up on writing about her life and really put the project aside and returned to novels and wrote two of those. And then when I came back to, she died by this point, that was a few years ago. When I came back to thinking about writing this, I knew that I would have to read this enormous document, the kind of big central document in our family history, which is written by my great-grandfather. And he'd written this memoir in the last 10 or so years of his life in German when he was living in America. And it's in German, it's almost 2,000 pages long, 1,800 and something. And even in the English translation, which my great-uncle very bravely took on, it's still over 500 pages on kind of big A4. So I knew that a lot of my family members had tried and failed to read this memoir, and it was in reading that and finally getting all the way through that story that I discovered right at the end, my great-grandfather makes what he frames as a confession, talking about how he worked with chemical weapons in Germany in the 1920s and 30s as a chemist, and his ongoing regret and remorse about doing that.
But there's a sort of, as you describe it, it sounds slightly like the, you know, the great unpublished novel in Martin Amis's The Information, where nobody can get more than a few pages in it without getting a splitting migraine. You know, you get through this giant document, but it's always sort of comical because it's, as you put it, right up until the last 13 pages, it's essentially you know, whatever, 2,000 pages of throat clearing.
Yeah, it seems to me it's this amazing exercise in avoidance, you know, this huge borderline pathological attempt to, I guess I don't know for sure, but maybe he always intended to confess. But, you know, across 10 years, he couldn't quite bring himself to do it. So you just have him writing about his great aunt, writing about his holidays in Belgium, writing about speculations about distant family members. And then when you finally get to this confession, you think, wow, how did you not mention this earlier? Like, how could this be coming? In the German translation, it's on page 1620 or something. Like, how is this being held back to that point?
And is there a sense in which you, because your grandmother, as you describe it, she's kind of cagey. She was reluctant to answer questions about her early life and about her father and all. Is that, do you think, because she sort of knew this stuff?
That's a good question. She does, interestingly, I've subsequently listened to many more interviews with my grandmother than just the one I made. She was interviewed quite a lot over the years, sometimes in German, sometimes in English. And she does talk about his work with chemical weapons a little. And she does, you know, note that it's strange. I'm not sure how aware she was at the time. She would have been really quite young. So there's a question. She definitely knew a little bit about it, but I'm not sure she knew all that much. Certainly not as much as I have subsequently found out.
And how did a Jewish guy end up working with the Nazis in the way he did?
Yes, good question. Well, it was incremental is the answer to that. You know, in actually, this is one of the family stories that everyone did share. In the early 1920s, he was a chemist making radioactive toothpaste. So that was the kind of beginning of his work with this company, chemical company outside of Berlin. And so he made toothpaste for a while, and then he moved into the gas mask, so-called protection department. So that was in maybe 1926. And in working in the gas mask department, he came in contact with chemical weapons because in order to test the effectiveness of the gas masks, you have to get the latest chemical weapons to make sure they're working with them. And then a few years later, he's offered another promotion, or promotion in inverted commas, to the chemical weapons department. So, yeah, it kind of happened incrementally. And that was still in late 1920s, like 1928. So that question of how he ended up doing it with the Nazis, he was already in the job and he remained in the job when the Nazis came to power. And so, yeah, there was 2 years there, 1933 to 35, where he was the director of the chemical weapons laboratory, and suddenly his colleagues were, you know, military men with strong connections to the Nazis.
What's your sense of his character? There's a sort of subtext, at least initially, that, you know, he dreamed of creating some extraordinary discovery or
right.
You know, he was all sort of like, I want to be the chemist who wins the Nobel Prize. And there was a kind of thwartedness in him, wasn't there?
There really was. That was such a strong strand in his personality. He'd grown up in the kind of golden age of German science. You know, everyone was discovering, it felt like, you know, well, X-rays were discovered shortly after he was born, and it happened just down the road. And then, you know, people discovering, filling in the periodic table, amazing revelations. He was taught in Munich University by various Nobel Prize winners. And it felt like he was in the heart of, he was in exactly the right place at the right time in order to have a, you know, world-changing scientific discovery. And obviously, like thousands of other scientists, that wasn't the case. He was more of a middling guy, but he always felt disappointed with that. I think he was told in school, you know, he was the kind of one of the prodigies of his school. And I think there was expectation that he was going to be maybe more brilliant than he was. So he did kind of keep that. And that my mum managed to get hold of his psychiatric notes from many decades later in the 1950s. And, you know, that was still really one of his central regrets, was that his life had never come to be as important as he'd hoped it would be.
And in those early years working with this kind of gas mask factory and making, you know, synthesizing these chemicals, there's a kind of, he's got a young family. Mm. They're right round the corner. Mm. And I think you've been to see this weapons factory, about which there seems to be a kind of paucity of information. I mean, you dig up as much as you can.
Yeah.
What was the situation then? Do you get a sense of how he felt about it all?
Well, again, there's not a huge amount written about it, because there's what he writes in his memoir, which he says, you know, we lived, it's 100 metres or so from the chemical weapons factory. I heard my granny talking about it the other day in another interview, saying how much it stank. Their apartment had, it just stank from the fumes from the, I think, guess not from the chemical weapons laboratory, but from the surrounding chemical factories. So they were that close and they could hear the machinery from their apartment. And he was working with these various chemicals, mustard gas, chlorine gas, tear gas. And there had been, around the same time, accidents in Germany in other chemical weapons laboratories that had killed people. There was one near Hamburg, 1928, I think, where I think 12 people died. So he was very conscious that there were serious risks, and accidents did sometimes happen. And he's got these two young kids around the corner. So I think he was very aware of those risks, although, yeah, again, he doesn't write about it a huge amount.
As, obviously, the Nazis come into power, there starts to be a whole series of measures taken against their Jewish citizens. Where was he in all that?
Well, his company was actually originally a Jewish-owned company. So they were going through a process of being Aryanized from 1933 onwards. The Jewish owners were forced to sell, and some Jewish employees were pushed out. He wasn't. Well, I guess he was ultimately, because he had to go to Turkey. But for at least 2 years, he kept his position. I think probably because there weren't many people with his expertise in the job he was doing. And the company was, throughout the 30s, slowly Aryanized. But there's another interesting thing, that the town they lived in, this place, Oranienburg, was much more exposed to elements of the Nazi state apparatus than most small towns.
Well, Sachsenhausen's around the corner, isn't it?
Sachsenhausen's around the corner, which they started building, I think, while they were still living there. But they also had this early concentration camp in the town, in an old brewery. It was for political prisoners, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like Sachsenhausen. But they used to see the prisoners being marched up and down the streets from their windows and hear them in the morning. So it was a place where you actually probably got a better sense of what the Nazis were doing than most small German towns at the time.
As I understand it, at least initially, kind of, he justifies to himself the work he's doing because it's defensive and it's theoretical.
Mm.
How much do you think that denial sort of was sustainable for him? Because there's various things where he says, I didn't get involved with the Nazi Party, I didn't write for these Nazi publications, and then you find, oh, actually he did.
Mm-hmm.
How do you read all the, you know, his state of mind and those subsequent evasions?
Yeah, I feel like that kind of rationalizing is very human in a way, and I empathize with, you know, we're all kind of story makers of our own pasts, aren't we? And we kind of find ways to tell the story in a way that is the most comfortable. And he is clearly doing that. I think, yeah, he makes quite a big deal about this idea of, like, chemical weapons for research versus chemical weapons for actually, like, stockpiling. Preparing for war versus preparing for war if war should happen, or actually making war. And so he obviously clings to that quite closely and seems to still think of that as an important distinction decades later. I don't know. Like, it's hard to know to what extent he knew what his bosses were up to. At the same time as he was working in this research laboratory, his bosses were off building an enormous chemical weapons factory in this town called Ammendorf, which became the most productive chemical weapons factory in Germany. Tens of thousands of tons of mustard gas stored in huge underground tankers. This was not theoretical. It was very much real. But then again, I don't know. Like, he never mentions that factory. There are almost no records about it. So it's kind of speculative at this point to wonder how much he was lying to himself or didn't know.
There's this very chilling juxtaposition, I think, where you describe him writing an article, I think it's about concentrations of carbon dioxide that, or carbon monoxide, sorry, that can the effects that has on human beings and confined spaces and so forth. And it's sort of over the page, isn't it, from this guy who was busy designing those gas fans, which were the early extermination tools of the Nazis.
Right, yeah, Dr. Gravitz. That was so chilling. That was, well, it's this magazine, a quite ominous magazine, ominous looking magazine called Die Gasmaske, a German industry magazine, essentially for the gas industry. But you can see, like, the British Library's got the whole run of that magazine, and you can see it becoming Nazified across, starts in 1929, I think it finishes in 1939, and, you know, by the end, it's completely Nazified and has pictures of the SS troops being trained in gas mask technique and all this sort of thing. But my great-grandfather said in his memoir that he'd never written for the magazine and he didn't like it and all this stuff, and he had written a couple of articles. And I can see why, like, looking at that magazine in the British Library, you can really see why he would have wanted to forget. Like, it's the company he's keeping is, yeah, frightening.
There's a kind of horror comedy to that magazine, which you play up. I think it's from that magazine, isn't it? You have a photograph, as you describe it, kind of, you know, a happy, carefree family sitting around with their gas masks, enjoying a game of Scrabble.
It is like that. It's... And also pictures of little girls playing Ring of Roses in their gas masks, and other photo shoots of people doing their calisthenics with their gas masks on, and, you know, just trying to normalize. I think the historian I read described the magazine's kind of ultimate purpose as to prepare the German population for horror. And it's this sense of trying to domesticate things which... they look absolutely terrible. There's no getting around it. It looks terrifying. But they're trying to turn it into this, oh, you know, you make a cup of tea, you pop your gas mask on. Yeah.
That sort of touches on something that really fascinates me about this book, because, you know, to some extent it appears when it starts to fall into this quite well-established genre of, you know, my grandmother, my great-father, you know, I find a trove of things in the attic.
Yeah.
She ran away from the Nazis. Mm-hmm. I go and investigate. But this is really consistently funny and kind of comical. There's a little bit, I mean, flavour to me, I don't know whether you're a fan of Jeff Dyer about it, of the sort of thwarted research trips. And
yeah, of course. And in fact, I read Out of Sheer Rage in the middle of writing this book. But yeah, Jeff's obviously a master of that.
I mean, did the humour of it kind of come through naturally, or was there a sort of reckoning you had with, okay, this subject matter is in some ways extremely serious?
Mm.
Oh, shouldn't joke about that, or is it just instinct?
It was both. I mean, as you probably know, my natural writing voice is comic, and my novels have been comic, and so that is how things come to me. But also, I did think hard about can you write about this subject with that voice? Is it appropriate to do so? There are sections of this book, some very dark and painful sections of this book, which are not funny, and I don't write them as funny. And one of the interesting, I guess, challenges from a writing point of view was to work out a structure. Like, they were so full on, those passages, that I felt like, you know, you really have to kind of protect them from any frivolousness. So it was almost like they needed a buffer, a joke-free buffer of, you know, 20 pages on either side, because you can't put them in relationship to each other. But at the same time, I think humour has always been a really important processing and emotional deflection technique in my family. Like, that's what we do. We're not good emotional. We can't talk about our feelings, so we tell a joke instead. So it felt authentic to my family story to have that humor in there. Like, that is, unfortunately, for better or worse, that is how we speak to each other, rather than, you know, discussing the darkness in our history. We'll just make a joke. So it felt true to that as well.
I sort of love the running joke of you constantly asking your mother to come on research trips to these chemically irradiated or terrible places. And she's like, oh, yeah, no, thank you, dear. No, thank you.
I'm going to go on a walking holiday, yeah.
Well, tell me a bit about your research and how, because obviously there's this crux when he moves to Ankara. And why does that happen? And what did you find when you, as it were, followed him there?
Yeah, so he moved to Ankara. He got offered a job working for the Turkish Red Crescent in Ankara, who are the kind of equivalent to the International Red Cross. And
sounds very benign.
It sounds really benign, and that is how it had been passed down in our family story, you know, that after doing this questionable work in Germany, he then, you know, worked for the Turkish Red Crescent, and that has this lovely humanitarian ring to it. And
redemption arc.
Redemptional narrative. Yeah, that's the lovely narrative shape which we all bought into. And this is another really strange detail, because in his memoir, he's very clear that the moment I got to Ankara in this new job and our new life, and we'd left Nazi Germany behind, I never worked with chemical weapons again. The burden fell from my shoulders, and what a relief it was. And that he's very clear about that. And then, but he also has kept all his work letters from those years, which completely contradict that statement. So I can't, in my head, I'm still struggling to work out, why would you write in your memoir one thing? You know, if you really want to tell that lie, you have to destroy the letters too, but he doesn't. He keeps his letters. So eventually I translated the work letters, or my mum translated them, I should say, from his time in Ankara. And it's clear that, well, A, he was still, 50% of his wages were still being paid by his old company in Berlin. And he was still very much in conversation with them about all his developments. It was a kind of shared project between his old company in Berlin and the Turkish military. To call it the Turkish Red Crescent, well, it's true, it was them technically, but it's pretty misleading. It was much more about the Turkish military. So he was making gas masks for the Turkish army, and he was also helping the Turkish government to buy chemical weapons from Germany, which they then used in the east of Turkey in a Kurdish region called Dersim. So these are all things that I kind of only discovered when we really pored over his work letters, and my mum helped me translate them.
Yeah, you got it. There's, again, one of these comic details that I think your mum has some highlighter pens she used for these translations. Could you tell us about this colour scheme?
Well,
it's a very good impressionistic way of reading these letters.
That's right. Well, she's much more rigorous than me, and she's a proper academic, retired now. But yeah, so she took to these letters and translated them, but also gave them thematic a colouring system, you know, kind of be red for, or green for his health problems, green for the Nazis, blue for whatever else it was. So I could kind of flick through and see what was emerging at a glance. Yeah, she was very, very good on that. It was all happening during various lockdowns. So I think she felt like she had some spare time.
And what were your granny's memories of that time in Turkey?
Well, that was the thing. They had a really nice, they felt so lucky. You know, they felt, they'd lost their citizenship. They were stateless by 1940, but their time in Ankara was amazingly fortunate. They, you know, the country stayed neutral for most of the war. They had a community there. My great-grandfather kept his job throughout the war. They made friends. They loved it. Their memory of it was incredibly positive, which again, that's kind of the family story, and this idea that he was doing humanitarian work fitted into that story of it all kind of going right from the moment they got to Ankara. But obviously it was a little bit more complicated than that. But from my granny's point of view, as a teenager by that point, she learned Turkish really quickly. She fell in love. She, you know, eventually met my grandfather, and it was a good time.
Now, you mentioned the use of the chemical weapons sort of genocide in Dersim. Possibly the darkest bit of the book is your trip to Dersim, because that's a piece of past that's not even past.
Not even past, yeah. And, you know, looking at what's going on in Turkey right now, you see it's a part of Turkish history which is not officially recognised. And, well, that's not true. It is now officially recognised as of, I think, 2012, but only in a very limited way. I think according to official Turkish documents, 13,000 people were massacred in Dersim in 1937 and 38. Other historians put that number as 3 or 4 times higher, but it's still not, you know, there are no memorials there. There's nothing recognizing it officially. And that part of Turkey is still very much a police and army state. There are checkpoints everywhere. There are watchtowers on the hill in the town. There's full of police and soldiers. And that's a legacy of this oppression that started in the 1930s.
As you investigated this story, I mean, there's a very sort of poignant and well-balanced moment where you find yourself sort of slightly lost for words with someone. I think it's in Dersim, where you're sort of almost apologising to each other. You find yourself feeling, whether rightly or wrongly or involuntarily, a kind of inherited guilt for your grandfather's work.
Yeah. It's interesting. I really did become lost for words. I kind of lost the ability to speak. I felt like I was disappearing down a hole. And I don't know whether it, I guess...
Who was the man you were speaking to? Sorry, we should contextualise that for the listeners.
The moment you're referring to is actually in Germany. I was speaking to a man called Eric Gadder. But similar moments happened in Turkey, speaking in particular to an amazing man called Ali Ekbarkaya, who was the head of the human rights organisation there for a long time and has spent his whole life trying to get recognition for the things that happened in Dersim. And for doing that, he's been detained and tortured and has suffered threats and still suffers threats to this day. And I think it was partly... I mean, I'd need an analyst to talk this through with, but it probably was partly a kind of inherited shame and guilt. It was also just the force of the stories I was hearing and the force of the feelings and the bravery of the people I was speaking to was, it kind of silenced me.
I mean, there's a sort of, which feels like a kind of wonderful ready-made metaphor. A theme of the book is just contaminated soil. And, you know, there's a whole sort of, again, serio-comic thread of you running around with a Geiger counter that you bought off Amazon. How does that play out through the book?
I got the Geiger counter quite early on, started getting into the... Well, I guess it starts with the radioactive toothpaste. You know, that was the initial thing. And you start thinking about that. And when I went to Oranienburg, I took the Geiger counter with me thinking correctly that it's a highly radioactive town. It's the most radioactive town in Germany. And it is because of the remnants of the radioactive toothpaste. Basically, in the 1920s, they used... It's called monazite sand, and they extracted thorium from monazite sand. And so there were huge piles of this radioactive sand around the factories. And then after the town was bombed at the end of the war in 1945, they filled the bomb craters with whatever they could find, in this case, radioactive sand. So the reason Oranienburg is still radioactive is because there are these crater-shaped zones of radioactivity where they shoved radioactive sand into the ground. So it's one of those... It's an insane town because it's got all these unexploded World War II bombs underneath the soil and it's radioactive. So I took my Geiger counter there. I mean, with, in retrospect, complete naivety and lack of deep understanding of what I was doing, thinking that maybe it would guide me to some revelation. And I had my shovel as well. And I went to where I thought the chemical weapons laboratory had been, and I dug a hole and I sent it off to the lab, as you would having watched a Hollywood film. And of course it came back from the lab. Well, it wasn't soil you'd want to grow plants in, but it was not radioactive or toxic. But yeah, there was quite a few of those kind of quixotic moments of imagining myself making the great revelatory discovery in person and then often being let down.
So when the kind of war comes to an end, what causes your grandfather and his family to leave Turkey and how do they end up here?
Yeah, my granny met my grandfather in Ankara. He was working for the British Council, or so we've been led to believe. There are many in my family who think he was a spy, which is not impossible either. But anyway, she met him and that he was Scottish and they went back to... As my mum describes it, it was a shotgun marriage of convenience so that she could get a passport. They married on VE Day and moved to Scotland. But my great-grandfather, they weren't able to get Turkish citizenship despite wanting to. And so he followed his son to America. And that's where he spent most of his final years, was in the East Coast.
And... Again, a sort of peculiarity and a kind of moral wrinkle in the book is that he kind of, again, having said, I don't, against the Nazis, I didn't participate in this, I was doing this under duress, I was doing this in a theoretical and defensive, all those things. But that his old boss, who's coming under all sorts of, as you would expect, the boss of a chemical weapons factory through the 30s and 40s would, is coming under a lot of tension from the post-war denazification program.
Right.
And he's sending very friendly communications. Indeed, he writes him a testimonial, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. The phrase I always remember, there were lots of these dodgy testimonials given after the war, and they used to call them Perlscheine. The basically, these were, you asked your friends to write you letters of reference that would make you come out clean. And he writes this letter defending his old boss from any accusations of being a Nazi. He doesn't mention, of course, their work with chemical weapons together. And he sends it back to Germany. And my take on that is that this old boss did help get him and his family out of Germany. Like, he did get him the job in Turkey, and they had a good life and they escaped. And I think he felt indebted to this person, regardless of their work history together, and felt he owed him that favour.
There's also sort of one of your excellent accidental revelations is you thought that the memoir ended on page 2000, but there was another bit.
Yeah, there's another bit that I wasn't aware of, and it was only in the Jewish Museum in Berlin. That's where a lot of the family records are kept. And I went to look at the big German original memoir, the 2000 pager, and found there was an unbound extra volume on top written about the years 1933 onwards, which I thought was the treasure chest I'd been waiting to find, the revelator, all the kind of unsaid things I imagine were going to be said in these loose pages, one of which had been burnt at the corner. It had like a burn mark and made me think, you know, this, my great-grandfather came close to setting fire to these documents, but in the end he changed his mind. And then I sent the documents off to my translator, and I was waiting, you know, 2 weeks for them to come back, thinking about all the things I was going to learn and how it was going to change my book completely. And then they came back, and essentially he'd spent, it was another 150 pages, but he'd spent all those pages reiterating essentially what his encyclopedia entry about the Weimar Republic, about the polarization of political viewpoints in the 1920s. And it was just another huge throat clearing exercise, like an extra throat clearing. And then at the very end, he says, oh, I'm sorry, my memory is fading. I actually can't tell you anything more about after 1933. And it's just, yeah, another kind of like enormous groan of disbelief.
In the States, I mean, there is a sort of, not quite a coda, but he does have this breakdown in later life. Mm-hmm. How do you read that? And can you explain a bit about what light that sheds on him and his earlier career?
Right. So in the late 1950s, he's hospitalized for not that long, 11 nights in a psychiatric unit in North Carolina. And in his memoir, he directly puts it down to his regret and shame. He says, I never recovered from, you know, my regret about the work I did, and that depression stayed with me for the rest of my life. He puts it that way, which is interesting because when we amazingly managed to get the psychiatric notes, I say we, again, my mum managed to get hold of the psychiatric notes. She charmed someone in the North Carolina hospital archive, and they managed to dig out this incredible document, 60 pages of Freudian analysis and a full physical, like the most intrusive physical exam you could imagine, describing every body part in detail. Anyway, this kind of arrived in the post to my mum's house. And it was a revelation in that we finally, you know, got to see his inner thoughts and not the person he was pretending to be in his memoir. But it did not contain reams of him talking about how guilty he felt. It was much more, well, it was kind of much more petty than that, but also more human in a way. Like we talked about it earlier on, him regretting never having had a successful career. It seemed like the things that were really troubling him and he was reflecting on in hospital were not about guilt and shame, but just regret that his life hadn't turned out the way he hoped it would. He was now, he didn't like his boss, his work was bad, his son was having loads of success in science that he wasn't having, like his son had become a professor in quantum physics. And it
you're slightly sceptical about his expressions of pride for his son, though.
I am a little sceptical. I mean, that's, I do feel a little bit mean about that. Like, maybe maybe you say things to your, you know, doctors that, maybe that was a passing thought on his part. But yeah, he is, he does seem to be a little bit hurt by his son seemingly cruising into the exact career that he hoped for himself. By this point, his son's in Princeton working with Oppenheimer and Einstein, and it's a bit galling for him.
What's he doing at this point?
Working in a paint factory in New Jersey. You can see why he might be a little bit sore about it. But it's interesting because it feels to me very human, because the things he talks about and complains about, you know, he says his wife's had affairs or possible affairs, and that's playing on his mind. He feels his body's failing him. He's getting old, and that's playing on his
mind. His wife seems to be gay, if I'm understanding you right.
That's my take. My mum disagrees, but yeah, that's my version.
How much did he face up to that, do you think?
He had rationalised that as well. He had found a way to think about that, which was comfortable for him. Like, he put it that she had lost her mother in early childhood, and these strong female relationships were a compensation for having lost her mother. So it was a very like Freudian take on that, and that's how he seemed to cope with it.
At the end of the book, which sort of ties it up kind of perfectly in a one way, is you've become German.
I have become German. I'm a dual citizen.
Did you feel ambivalent about that as you were obviously closing in on this end of this book?
Yeah, it's interesting. Me and my sisters, I think, as maybe as clear characteristically, had kind of compartmentalised a little bit and weren't thinking too deeply about, you know, Brexit had happened and we wanted to kind of, wanted for our children as well to be European. But my mother did not let us off the hook that easily. And when we were in the German embassy getting our passports, the very nice lady from the embassy kind of said, you know, what would your grandmother think about you taking citizenship? And we were all prepared to say, oh, I'm sure she would have been fine about it. And my mum was like, no, she wouldn't have been fine about it. She wouldn't have liked it at all. So we had to sit with that discomfort. And I'm sure my mum's right. I don't think my granny would have liked it. Yeah, so I am aware of that. And it definitely is complicated. But I feel like the Germans are maybe not unique, but particularly good at kind of acknowledging and living with that complexity and those ambiguities. You know, that was very much part of the embassy process, was to say, she said, you know, if you want to change your mind at this point and decide not to become German, that is totally okay. We'd gone through 2 years of form filling and jumping through hoops and all this stuff, and we were finally in the room, and she was like, by the way, if you have like a moment where you decide, actually, you know what, I'm not into this, that's also completely fine. I thought that was so interesting and so German in a way to have put that out there.
It's quite a weird detail that you become German the moment you pick up these papers.
That's what she told us, yeah. That does seem so strange, doesn't it?
Now, funny, you know, in the process of researching this book, I feel from reading it that you came to know your great-grandfather pretty well in all his strange complexity. What do you feel towards or about him now? Do you feel you like him or forgive him?
I like him. I like him. I do really like him. Do I forgive him? I understand him. I don't know if I... Yeah, I'm not sure about forgiveness, but I understand him and I like him and I empathise with him. And I understand how he got into the situation he did. I guess I don't want to necessarily make this about like some clean, cathartic final feeling of relief, you know, like I'm comfortable with it being uncomfortable. So I don't want to say, oh, you know, I understand completely how he made those decisions. I don't totally understand how he made those choices, but I do like him.
Joe Dunthorne, thank you very much indeed for your time. Children of Radium is out any day now.
Thanks, Sam.